Coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas, and recorded live, Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
And want to remind those of you listening on radio, you can also hear us commercial-free online at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Well, with the President's recent announcement that he's going to have the EPA go around Congress and put emission controls, raising our electric rates, we decided to get a hold of one of the more accessible members of Congress, Michael Burgess, the 26th District Congressman from Texas. He's on the prestigious Energy and Commerce Committee, and Michael is very good. He returns phone calls most promptly. Science News Radio Network. Yes. Oh, hi, Congressman Burgess. Good to hear from you.
Well, sir, how are you doing?
Well, I'm doing quite well. I haven't spoken to you in a while, and I think the last time we spoke, it was about the same subject. President Obama has announced that he's going to go around Congress and use the EPA to limit emissions at coal plants, and of course the study that the Congress did nearly 2 years ago now was showing that it's going to drastically raise our electric rates. And I'm wondering, since you're on the House Energy and Commerce Committee, if you can tell us how you guys are going to fight this.
I can talk in general terms.
Sure, yeah. No, I know it's probably too early to get into specifics, but yeah, if you can give me kind of an outline of maybe a guidance or a course about how this may happen.
Well, the problem, of course, you shouldn't be trying to circumvent Congress in the first place, because that's why we have three branches of government. It's his job to execute laws, we write them. But a lot of times this administration gets confused on that fact, even though the president is a constitutional scholar. I'm just a simple country doctor, and I get that distinction. I wish he did. This is not new. The administration, of course, has been putting this forward for some time. In fact, this month, I think we're at the four-year anniversary of the passage of what was called the Waxman-Markey Act, which was the cap and trade bill that the president wanted passed in his first term.
Oh,
the House
yeah.
passed it in June of 2009, and then the Senate never took it up, and it died at the end of that Congress.
Sure.
But even though he lost on the legislative front, many of the same concepts continued to be pushed by Lisa Jackson, who at the time was the administrator at the Environmental Protection Agency, and certainly that was that whole entire agenda continued to be pushed from the regulatory side, even though they'd failed on the legislative side. Now, when the Republicans took control of the House back in right after the 2010 election, starting in 2011, we pushed back on the EPA, and of course there have been an entire series of hearings that took place in the last Congress, and in fact we just had another one today in the Energy and Power Subcommittee. But pushing back on the Environmental Protection Agency and these regulations, of course, some of them have worked their way through the courts, and I think you recently had the Supreme Court rule on the E15 mandate, which has to do with ethanol and gasoline.
Mm-hmm.
Not a good idea, but the court said, okay, we're all right with that. But the court did push back on the cross-state air pollution rule, which was one of the centerpieces of the Environmental Protection Agency's regulatory scheme for preventing coal-fired power plants not just from being built, but from operating, mm-hmm. current ones from operating in the state of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole concept, I think it was 3 years ago, we had one of the hottest Aprils ever. We had some serious power shortages, and the governor said, we've got to do something about this. But the EPA was really trying to position itself that coal would not be in that mix. But Texas is also a natural gas producing state, so a lot of electricity generation has switched over to natural gas, but we still rely on those older coal-fired power plants to provide us our base load of electricity that we so desperately need. What's the temperature outside today, Colonel? 98 degrees?
Yeah, you've done your homework. Yeah, we're up near 100.
So it's, it's June. It's going to be hot in Texas. No surprise there. This is not part of some global conspiracy. It's always hot in Texas in the summertime. But we know we're going to need electricity to run the air conditioners. And the EPA seemed to think that they could simply, through regulatory fiat, strike down a number of electricity-producing coal-fired power plants. Now, I think the president in his speech and outlining his executive order agenda wants to continue down this path. He probably wants to go a little farther. Congress does have the ability to legislate over those executive orders, and while our task right now is more difficult because the Senate rarely agrees with anything that the House does, and vice versa, to be completely honest about it, but the difficulty right now is the fact that there is divided government. But I think we, as the House, we have to continue to push back against this this agenda that's being driven by the administration, because ultimately it's the consumer that's hurt, it's the ratepayer that's hurt, it's the person who's living on a fixed income who's hurt, it's the person who is trying to stretch from paycheck to paycheck and pay, yes, their gas bills, their light bills, their cooling bills, that find that their dollar doesn't go as fast, or I'm sorry, as far as it used to. It goes faster, but not as far as it used to. And these policies have a direct impact on the people who are living in North Texas. I mean, there's no question about it. There's a direct correlation. So we'll continue to fight that fight on the regulatory front. You know, people used to ask me last fall, you know, what's your biggest fear going into this election? And I would reply, my biggest fear is that nothing changes. And of course, that's exactly what happened on election day. The president was returned to the White House. The Democrats held power in the Senate, and conservatives held power in the House of Representatives. So the people, in their wisdom, voted for this divided government that we've got now. I hope they perhaps figure things out before we have another election a little over a year from now. But right now, the situation is you do have House conservatives going up against the Senate Democrats, and of course you've got the president who doesn't have legislative authority but decides to rule by executive fiat, and we have to be prepared to hold him in check and where possible back those regulations down or back the agency down. The good news on the good news front, of course, Lisa Jackson left the Environmental Protection Agency. There is an acting director there now who actually seems reasonable. Gina McCarthy, who is the person who has been nominated to fill Lisa Jackson's position. I have not had a good relationship with her when she was an assistant administrator at the EPA, so I'm hopeful that my friends over in the Senate on the Republican side can continue to tie that nomination up for a while longer.
All right. Well, it seems insanity. I mean, Europe has flirted with cap and trade. We put a stop to it 2 years ago, and the president insisting on going around Congress to rule by fiat can be a scary thing. And people are thinking that CO2 is dangerous. Well, it's only one out of eight greenhouse gases. There's seven other ones, and Brazil and China and others are not limiting, but we're willing to raise the taxes, or let's say the cost of living on Americans, so that we can somehow lead the way in this CO2 emissions. When what we ought to do is be saving our money and putting it into to forms of reducing whatever other greenhouse gases might be coming along. So there's a lot of concern about this. But what I'm getting from you is that there's nothing that can be done immediately, but how soon will these EPA things go into effect?
Well, Colonel, they won't be immediate either. The president can get out and make a lovely speech, and in fact, in many ways, that's his strong suit, is getting out and making a lovely speech. But he has to get these things through the, I mean, everything that goes through the, one of the regulatory agencies, there has to be a proposed rule, there has to be a notice of proposed rulemaking, there has to be a period of public comment. I mean, all of these things, none of these things are going to happen that the president outlined his speech, none of those things are going to happen in the immediate future. But he is proposing a more aggressive regulatory scheme that that he wants to see in place. But to tell you the truth, in some of these, they actually lack the legislative authority to go forward with the regulations that he's talking about. At the end of the day, they do require legislation for the agency to make some of these sweeping regulations. And I think, as I've indicated to you, it's unlikely that the House is going to go along with that request. There are plenty of things that the agency can do, and they will continue to do those, but none of those are going to be immediate either. It's not like by the end of the summer the president's going to have closed coal-fired power plants as much as he wants to. But, you know, there's a political price he's paying, too. And I went up and did some campaigning for a young congressional candidate named Andy Barr, who's from the eastern part of Kentucky. He won an election last fall largely on this issue. And when I went up and kind of rode his campaign bus around eastern Kentucky for an afternoon, mm-hmm. we went into business after business where people told him, you know, this has got to stop. This war on our livelihood, which in eastern Kentucky is coal, this has got to stop. And then these are people who, you know, historically they may have been, you know, sort of union-type Democrats, blue-collar Democrats. They'd had enough of it. They just weren't going to hear any more of this nonsense. Get out of our way and let us continue to produce the way we've always produced, the way our fathers produced before us and their fathers before them, which in coal country is coal mining.
Well, here we have a president who says that he wants to return people to work and keep the standard of living high, but replacing these energy jobs right now with alternative energy, those are low-paying jobs, and it seems that no one can seem to convince him otherwise?
Well, and as you know, as we saw, unfortunately, with the sad saga of Slender a few years ago, those jobs actually don't, sometimes in spite of a large infusion of government cash, they don't pan out, and that has, you know, look, I'm for renewables, too. I mean, Texas is clearly an energy-producing state.
Mm-hmm.
We're an all-of-the-above state.
Right.
We've got, of course, the natural gas production in our state.
Of course,
some coal production in the state of Texas, but we're big in solar. We're big in wind. We're big in hot air in Texas. I mean, that's one of the things we're known for, but Texas is an energy-producing state, mm-hmm. and to our credit, in the last, what, 5, 6, 7 years, the country has come from importing large amounts of its energy requirement. I mean, that has really scaled back. And sure, efficiency's played a role in that, but the production of energy in North Texas, down in South Texas, in the Eagle Ford Shale, that has been a big part of the story. And it's why the governor's been so successful in saying he's kept Texas recession-proof, because we have such a large a part of our production in a large part of our workforce in energy production. It has worked to the state's advantage through tough economic times.
Well, you make us feel a whole lot better, Congressman Burgess, with this phone call. I appreciate it. One more thing before you go, and I don't know if you want to comment on this or not, because it's just a little out of your realm, but you are in Congress. And doesn't it look a little silly to be going after a low-level guy like Edward Snowden when maybe the NSA and maybe Abu's Alan Hamilton should have been more protective of these state secrets that they say are so vitally important to American interest, and maybe we're prosecuting the wrong person? Maybe we should go after Clapper, head of the NSA, or maybe some of the people that should have been more careful about guarding these secrets?
Well, you make a good point, and I think that's going to be part of the discussion here for the next several months. But unfortunately, Mr. Snowden's case, grabbing a laptop and heading for Moscow probably wasn't his wisest decision. And I don't know who's advising him, but I wouldn't have encouraged him to do that. In fact, had he come here and asked for protection, you know, that might have been a different story, but it's going to be a tough sell going to a country that is as opposed to us as China is, and then flying to Moscow with some of those same sensitive materials. That can't be good for you in the long term.
Well, yes, and you make a good point, because Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times way back in, when was it, the late 60s, he stuck around and faced the music, didn't he?
Yes, he did. I don't remember, because I was just a baby when that happened.
You're so funny. I live that, Michael. I live that. I remember when that happened, and I remember he stuck around and faced the music and was eventually exonerated.
Yes, and he faced a tough time. I mean, his reputation was impugned, and his psychiatrist records were revealed. I mean, he had a tough time, but he did stick through it.
All right. Congressman Michael Burgess on the prestigious House Energy and Commerce Committee, and in the 113th Congress in this year, going to serve as vice chairman of both the Subcommittee on Health and Oversight and Investigation Subcommittees. You've been very kind to be with us. I can't tell you how much I really appreciate it, Mike. Thanks so much for the call.
Thanks, Colonel. We'll do it again soon. Bye-bye.
All righty. Take care. Bye-bye.
Stand by.
All right, we have in the line right now a guy we've been looking forward to talk to for quite a long time. He's a product manager at Google Crisis Response and Civic Innovation. His name is Nigel Snowd. He's an Aussie, and we're really proud to have him. Welcome to the program, Nigel.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Now, I don't understand much in the way of the structure at Google. Where does the Google Crisis Response and Civic Innovation come in? I mean, isn't the structure there kind of loosely knit, or are you guys really, really pretty well structured?
Well, look, it's a bit of both, I'll be honest, right? So what we've got is that there's a bunch of people inside Google who, whenever there's a disaster or a really major emergency around the world, sort of want to come together and do come together to try and figure out how we can help. You can imagine it's like anyone in a company. People want to help in their backyard. People want to help in their neighborhood. People want to see how we can use Google's tools and data and assets to make a difference. That's just natural. If you're in New York and Hurricane Sandy's coming and people are looking for a map, you happen to work for a company that does awesome mapping things, then you want to see how you can make that useful to people. And this is how this started inside Google sort of many years ago, sort of ad hoc efforts by individuals to try and see how they could help.
Okay.
And so for Hurricane Katrina, we found people were using Google Earth, and so we said, well, let's get satellite imagery there. That'll be really useful.
Mm-hmm.
And so various individuals did their thing. And it was sort of in 2010, in response to the earthquake in Haiti, where we kind of realized that this was common enough and useful enough, the kind of work that we could do when everybody came together to, for instance, do a hackathon internally to build a missing persons tool called Person Finder that we still use today, that was sort of important enough and consistent enough that we wanted to structure it and make sure it had good support. And then we housed it, and we decided in Google to put inside google.org, which is the sort of the philanthropic heart of Google's technical and other work. And so we sort of house a small core team there that sort of works with other parts of the company.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal is to figure out how we as a company can make the most difference to people affected by disasters and emergencies. And we do that in a few ways. We sort of certainly help when there's a big emergency, sort of scramble to figure out whatever it is we can do, working with our local teams and partners. And also we build some products that we sort of run day to day that we think are useful for others. I mentioned Person Finder that other people can use and launch. It's an open source product. And we have a few others, most notably our public alert system, which I'm sure I'll talk a bit more about.
All right, so you're gonna kind of cover these things at the Global Humanitarian Technology Conference, October 20th through the 23rd at San Jose Airport Garden Hotel in California, where you're a keynote speaker. And why don't we drill down on some of these things a little bit? How did Person Finder come about, and how is it working?
Well, Person Finder, as I said, came about because I don't know whether you were watching during the Haiti earthquake, and just recently you would have seen in the Sichuan earthquake in China, just a couple of months ago,
yeah,
that people get sort of lose track with each other in a major emergency. They're either displaced or they are truly missing because unfortunately something bad's happened to them. And the same was also true during the tsunami and earthquake in Japan 2 years ago now. And what we see in all those emergencies is that from physical notice boards to notice boards on Facebook or on mobile phone companies' discussion groups and chat services, everybody's sort of saying, I'm okay, and have you seen this person?
Yeah.
Right? I'm looking for someone.
Okay.
And if you've got that in 30 different places, and I think after Haiti we identified something like 14 or 15 different major places from newspapers through to online services where people were doing these sort of virtual notice boards, it means that if you're looking for someone, you've got to go to all those different places. So we've got an information fragmentation problem. And the way you deal with that is you have a data standard and you do information sharing and integration. And so the Person Finder Interchange Format, which is a data standard, has been around for several years, actually invented by someone on one of our teams. And it's called PFIF. And it was invented sort of around for Hurricane Katrina, actually, where this same problem existed, of missing persons in sort of data being in different places. And so what we did was we had a hackathon inside the company where we said, well, let's actually just make a tool that people can use to find, say they're okay, and find information, and even better, a tool that enables you to synchronize or share data across all these different endpoints. And that's what we did in 2010. It took about 72 hours for a bunch of Googlers from around the world in different offices and different continents to put together a basic tool to make that happen. And now it's open source. It's evolved quite a bit. We want to keep working on it. We have contributions from others as well. And it's really a valuable part of what we do. And an example of this is that whenever there's a significant earthquake in Japan, it's automatically turned on. The missing persons repository is turned on. That's integrated with a couple of the major mobile phone companies' networks and their messaging boards on their people's phones. So people can easily say, I'm okay, and it appears in Person Finder, and other people can then find it. And this is an example of something that just wasn't possible during the Tohoku earthquake in 2011 and was really an immense point of pain for a large number of people. And we use it quite regularly, and so we encourage others to use it too in an appropriate way.
Is this going to expand for other national emergencies, like, for instance, the Boston Marathon bombing or some other...
Well, we actually had Person Finder up and running for the Boston Marathon and a large number of entries in it there. Though we only run it for a short amount of time because of the fact that, you know, this is opt-in, it's very public, and we want people to be sharing information, and this is when people do share information about their locations and themselves right after a crisis. But it's different when the situation changes and it's not stuff you want to keep around for very long. But I also want to point out that there are certain types of crises for which it's really not appropriate, not the way we've built it. We've built it for natural disasters where there's not a political or a violent conflict that's a part of it, because the conditions for privacy and the conditions for sort of all sorts of information are quite different in those circumstances. And we've found it to be really useful for sort of these natural disasters and certainly for earthquakes and potentially floods and other things. But we're very cautious and careful about how we run it and use it as well. And there's some really great databases that are run by groups like the International Committee of the Red Cross that handle sort of the more conflict-related and effectively sort of the longer-running lookups of missing persons. And they're exactly the right and appropriate places for that to be.
Do you also work with, like, FEMA? Or how do you get the word out to these people? In the middle of a disaster, there's an incredible amount of confusion. Now we've got a break for the half hour. So, Nigel, when we come back the second half hour, let's pick it up from there. Okay. As we walk the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. In the Den of Strangers will we meet today?
Anne Rand, the only man capable of experiencing a profound romantic love is a man driven by passion for his work. Because love is an expression of self-esteem, of the deepest values in a man or woman's character. If a man has no clearly defined values and no moral character, he's not able to appreciate another person.